Hi, thanks for listening to the It's Not Just One Thing podcast series from Physio My Dog. I'm Harriet Kitkat and I'm from Physio My Dog. I'm a vet physiotherapist specialising in dogs, but I'm also a dog owner myself, and I'm also incredibly nosy and interested in knowing more and more about what we can do as dog owners, but also as therapists as to what we can do to help dogs. So I hope you find this series useful. Everyone for listening to our lovely podcast. I'm very excited about today because I am quite fascinated about the whole dog behavior thing. It's something that I'm interested in for my own dog, but also from a therapist perspective, it's something that obviously I come across every day is to how to best interact with dogs as part of my physio work. So every dog is different. Every dog's got different personalities, just like we have. So I'm really excited to be able to talk about this today with Adam, who I've got on the line. So I'm going to hand over to Adam in a second, but I've known Adam for a few, probably two or so years, maybe slightly longer, through my dog, Baxter, who, if you follow me on Facebook, you'll see that I post about him quite frequently. So I say that's how I've got to know Adam and done some of his workshops. So Adam, I know you do lots of different things, so I'm going to get you to introduce yourself in a second. So do you want to just tell everyone who you are, where you came from, like the Cilla Black of Blind Date, where everyone needs to do an introduction. So over to you.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm Adam. I have a dog training and behaviour business based around Bath and surrounding areas called Avon Dog Services. The business itself has been running almost 11 years. It'll be 11 years in April. And before that, I studied in animal behaviour and training as a degree level in Bishop Burton, which is in association with the University of Hull. So pretty much I've been doing this since I've left school. So it's kind of the only job or the only career that I've ever had. So fingers crossed it doesn't go downhill because there's no backup plan.
So does that mean that you always kind of knew that that's what you wanted to do?
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. From the first time we had a dog at 14, we took him to training classes and had kind of caught the bug. And that was it, really. And there was a couple of land-based colleges nearby, one of which was doing a national diploma in animal management, and started on that and then just kind of went from there, really.
Oh, that's cool. So, yeah. And did you ever have any dogs that had particular, so growing up as a kid and stuff with your family, did you have dogs that had like challenging behavior, or were they immaculately behaved?
No, not at all. So it's probably one of the reasons why I got into dog training, actually, or at least into the whole kind of care and welfare of animals. When I was 14, I pestered and pestered for a dog, as kids do. Our first dog was a German Shepherd because my mum had always had German Shepherds in the family when she was growing up. So basically it was either no dog or a German Shepherd. I didn't even mind. I wasn't bothered. I was happy just to have a dog. Looking back now, a German Shepherd is probably, you know, even though they were in the history, in the family history beforehand, probably could have chosen a slightly easier to start with, maybe. But yeah, he had difficulty socializing with other dogs. Trainer wise, he was pretty good. But it was kind of back in the day, really, when behavior wasn't really thought of that much as a kind of a need. It was just basic training classes and stuff, really. So yeah, from that point, it started to get a little bit more interested in what works, what doesn't work, and then like I said, a course nearby was there when I left school, and it was kind of start working for a living or kind of go to college,
yeah,
and carry on but I chose a college route, and yeah, I'm really glad that I did now.
Yeah, well, that's fab. So I know I'm going to pick your brains about some foundation stuff, but just before we get into that, sure. Do you want to just tell people how do you tend to work? I mean, how obviously I know COVID has changed a lot of how a lot of us work, but you know, in COVID times and in maybe non-COVID times, how do you tend to work with your clients?
Yeah, great question. So even before COVID times, we would have a bit of a blend between online sessions and in-person sessions. It was leaning a bit more heavily towards in-person sessions. So that's kind of what people want. But there's some things that we would need to do on online, things like separation related behaviors or separation anxiety. We'd always get to the stage of the owner going, oh, he's only showing off because you're here. And the fact is that you're there. That's why the dogs are performing a really good kind of relaxed settle whilst the owner's out of sight, is because you're there as an attachment. So actually doing things online gives you a much more true representation of the dog, which helps you then to kind of modify the behaviors and stuff from there. And then for the rest of it, it's more kind of in-person coaching. We do kind of regular meetups depending on the course or the program that somebody selected, whether that's a group class or whether that's a kind of a one-to-one program or something similar as well. So yeah, we kind of cover everything, and even kind of voice notes and calls and stuff, just to keep clients going with stuff in between sessions as well. So kind of blend everything together and just make sure that all the information is available for clients whenever they need it.
Yeah, okay. And then again, I know we're not going to go into all the different types of behaviours, but what type of cases do you tend to see? Do you tend to work with, in case people are listening and go, oh yeah, I want to see Adam about my dog who's got X issue? What kind of cases or behaviours do you tend to work with?
Good question. So there's a couple of things, or certainly one that I don't really cover too much because I send it off to a bit more kind of specialist, which is Resource Garden. That's mm-hmm. so many different kind of avenues that it could be for that one. So we have people who deal with that kind of predominantly. And so my main work that I do is dog-to-dog reactivity. I also do separation anxiety. And then we do group classes for basic training and puppy classes as well. So I get a kind of a nice fix between puppy classes and then the more kind of intricate work, which is the kind of the reactivity and the one that uses a lot of kind of the emotional reservoir, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, definitely. Okay, so what I wanted to pick your brains about today was kind of some sort of foundation stuff around behavior training, that type of thing, because as I kind of mentioned to you before, you know, I kind of grew up in the 80s. Well, I was born in the 70s, so my kind of like exposure, if you like, to sort of, we always had dogs growing up, and we did like puppy walking for Guide Dogs for the Blind, so we did that type of like training, I guess, that was kind of quite structured, I suppose, because of the type of dog that they were going to need to be or hope to be. But as a general kind of like dog owner, well, I was a daughter of my mum, obviously, was the main person that took care of the dogs, but you know, it was kind of like Barbara Woodhouse. You know, that was kind of that's all I really remember. So how, well, firstly, what is the difference between a dog trainer and a dog behaviorist? And how do you see that kind of work, training behavior type work, has it changed over the last 20, 30 years?
Yeah, so I suppose a trainer would be more looking at getting the dogs to perform a job. Things like sits, downs, what we would normally class as kind of basic training, or what most people now start to move into as life skills, teaching the dogs life skills, loose lead walking, strong recall, leaving unwanted items, sits, downs in rest areas and kind of coffee shops and cafes and stuff like that as well. So that would be kind of where I would class it as a trainer. Now there's a big overlap, there's a big blend, and it depends who you speak to as well. But then when you start to look at kind of behaviorists, the behaviorists will try and look at a much bigger picture of emotional responses. They'll look at reasons as to why the behaviors are happening. They'll look at any unwanted behaviors and any changes that the owners need to make. They'll probably have some intervention with medicines if they need to as well. And as you know, we've sent dogs your way to help out with pain related issues as well, that are definitely going to affect behavior. So I think a behaviorist would more likely cover more of the stuff that needs just a little bit more work or a little bit more information and just kind of looking into it. So a bit more of a holistic approach, basically.
And so how's all that changed then in the time that obviously you've been, you know, you growing up to how you work now? How's those processes and those training styles and types, how's all that changed from your perspective?
Hugely, actually. I remember when Finn was a puppy and we had him at sorry, Max, Finn's the most recent. So Max was the first dog that I had when I was 14. And I remember having to drive, well, I didn't, stepdad drove, I think it was about a half an hour, 40-minute journey just to do a class because there wasn't really anything else going on. It was just an ex-police dog handler who was doing training in a village hall. You turn up, put the check chain on, do your work, take the check chain off, put your own gear back on, and then go home again. And it was kind of just walking around in circles, sits and downs. And it's quite kind of, you know, I wouldn't say boring stuff, but it's kind of very, very repetitive. And the behavior at that point wasn't really thought of. It was just like, oh, you know, the dog's just acting up. You need to give it a firm hand. And that I think that was, well, certainly for when I was growing up in the area that I grew up in as well, that was kind of the mentality. And kind of fast forward 22 years. God, that's that's a long time.
Now we're realizing how
much. Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, fast forward kind of 21-22 years, and I think people are much more aware of the fact that the dogs have needs and that we shouldn't be overlooking those needs. And that's where the behavior starts to come in from, and the behaviorists start to become more prominent and more popular, because they're actually, they're actually making sure that the dog's needs are met, whereas previously it was just trying to stop the dog from doing something. Whereas now we're always looking at saying, well, actually, are you providing the dog with this correct outlet? Are you actually meeting their needs? Or are you just trying to suppress all behaviours? You know, that's the kind of the difference between the older styles and the newer styles that are coming through as well.
So what do you think caused, you know, what do you think made that change? Was there, you know, what do you think drove that change?
That's a tricky one. I think knowledge. So it's easier to gain more knowledge now. The internet's been fantastic for that. Yes, it's a bit of a minefield, and you pick up lots of stuff that potentially isn't going to be helpful or useful for your dog. But then there's also an abundance of information, YouTube, Google, all that you can find really at a quick click of a button, and you're there. Also, I just think generally people are just becoming a bit more aware of stuff and becoming a little bit more mindful and a bit more kind of empathetic as well. The whole, even kind of more recent tides of things like the increase of vegans. I mean, that's just, you know, a little bit more conscious about an animal and animals' needs and that side of things as well. So I think it's just a nice kind of progress that's happened over the years.
I wonder if you were to talk to like a human, kind of, I don't want to say a human behaviorist, because they're not really called those, but I guess it's probably a bit like, you know, I'm not a parent, but you know, the way I was brought up is always obviously very different to how a lot of kids are brought up now. Yeah. You know, and it's like, you know, I'm sure my mum won't mind me saying this, but you know, if my mum and dad wanted to go to the pub, then we kind of sat in, you know, I've got three brothers, so we would sit in the car given a bag of crisps and a bottle of Coke, which we probably had to share between us. And, you know, it was like, well, we're going into the pub, you lot sit out here. Whereas now, you know, families and kids and stuff are going into pubs as kids, and, you know, they're grown up with all of that. So I wonder if you were to plot, not you, but if you were to plot kind of like how that change has happened with bringing up children is to... it's the kids, and whether one drove the other one, I don't know, but it's the kind of like that parallel kind of way of working, I guess, with, and I'm sure, you know, I'm sure people that are parents and then get a dog, I'm sure they must be thinking, actually, yeah, there's some, I mean, I hear it a lot with my clients that have got babies and children, so, and dogs, is like, yeah, you know, God, it's just like having a newborn again, you know, when they get a puppy, that type of thing. So, so tell me a little bit more then about how, you know, what is the kind of, I know there's lots of studies and stuff like that goes on and kind of theories. So tell us a little bit more about maybe some of the science, without getting too techie, but some of the science around, you know, people hear positive reinforcement and that type of thing a lot now. So tell us a little bit more about how all of that kind of works.
Yeah, perfect. So there's a few different kind of learning theories, two of which are the most common and most popular are your classical conditioning and your operant conditioning, which is what you've mentioned there, which is where the kind of the positive reinforcement falls under. So if we look at that as a starting point, operant conditioning is basically kind of like it's classed as kind of four quadrants. So you've got positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement. You've also got negative punishment and then positive punishment as well. So if we were looking at it in terms of scientific methodology, you would look at positive as being adding something. So positive doesn't mean it's good. It just means you are adding or providing something. And the negative is something that you would remove. And then you've obviously got the reinforcement, which is designed to increase the likelihood of a behavior occurring again. And then you've got the punishment, which is designed to decrease the likelihood of that behavior occurring. So with those kind of quadrants, you've got options of whether you add a punishment or take something away to kind of punish your behavior, or start to use your reinforcements where you add something and take it away as well. So that one relies more on what the dog has done as to whether we deem that to be a good behavior or a not so good behavior, and then we reward afterwards. So that one is more like a kind of like a conscious decision that the dog has to make, basically.
Okay, so there's quite a lot there, isn't there, for people? If people have never heard that before, it's like, blimey, what's all this? What's all these quadrants?
Yeah.
So can we go through those four things, and then so people can kind of understand like what some examples of these things would be and what kind of ultimately we're wanting? So I guess starting with something like, say, positive reinforcement. Great. What is like an example of positive reinforcement?
Perfect. So positive reinforcement is, so you're adding something that acts as a reward for a desired behavior. So let's assume every time the dog sits or performs a sit, so, you know, a good behavior such as a sit, and that's what you're happy with. If you give that dog a treat every time they've sat, then they are more likely to keep sitting, obviously providing that they like the treat and it's a good treat for them. They are more likely to keep offering it because they know it works for them and they know it's a benefit to them. So there's no reason why they shouldn't want to keep doing that, because the more they sit, the more rewards they get from there.
Okay. And then what would be a negative reinforcement?
Yeah. So negative reinforcement is when you remove something that acts as a reinforcement for whatever the dog has just done. So let's just assume the dog is pulling on a lead, and I certainly don't agree with these, but the check chains or the, you know, the half checks, anything that tightens around the dog's neck. So when the dog is pulling, there's that tension and kind of unpleasant feeling around the neck. And what negative reinforcement aims to do is when the dog has slackened off the lead, that will remove the tension around the neck. So
that's the negative.
That's
bit.
The negative bit is. So you've removed the tension from around the neck, and the reinforcement comes because now the dog has a much more pleasurable sensation around its neck.
Right. Okay.
So the risk of that is they've had to go through a lot of stress, a lot of strain, a lot of tension around the neck for that to even take shape or for that to even happen. So with the negative reinforcement and the negative punishment, they're kind of amber because they have the ability to work, but there's a little bit of kind of not so good stuff that the dog has to go through at that point as well.
So what would be, so say you've got a dog that's pulling on the lead, and like you say, you know, the example you've just given would be using a check chain or something. What would be a positive way? Positive, you have to be really careful when I say positive, because like you say, it doesn't always mean good. So what would be a nicer way of dealing with that problem?
Yeah, great question. So with positive reinforcement, we'd be always looking for the stuff that we want the dogs to do and steering them in a really good kind of direction. So you could start from home, house or garden areas, and you pop the lead on where the dogs are likely going to be a little bit calmer. That's not to say all dogs, some dogs get excited just when the lead comes out. But in general, if you've got the lead in the garden and you're doing some games with the dog, they'll usually start to kind of slow down and relax a little bit. So your positive reinforcement would basically be any time the lead is relaxed, you reward the dog. So they don't have to do anything in particular. They just have to be relaxed on the lead. They could be in a sit, a stand or a down or walking around. But if that lead remains relaxed, then you're good to go with the reward. And then all you start to do is add in a little bit of movement. And if the dog starts to follow and keep the pressure off the lead, good things happen.
Yeah.
So you're actually actively trying to promote the loose lead behaviors rather than just waiting for the dogs to stop pulling, if that makes sense. So that's the difference between positive reinforcement, where you're trying to add something and promote something that you want, rather than negative reinforcement, where you're just waiting for that bad thing to stop to then say, doesn't that feel better?
Yeah, so it's more of a positive approach. Yeah. Oh, sorry, it's a more of what's the word? Proactive approach.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, no, I'm so great.
Yeah.
I'm so joking.
See, we all get positive reinforcement.
I know. People listen and they go, oh, God, he's fallen for it again. So that's positive reinforcement and negative reinforcement. And then, so let's talk about negative punishment and positive punishment.
Okay, good. So negative punishment is removing something that will punish that behavior. So let's just assume a dog starts to jump up you've got a treat in your hand and the dog starts to jump up. If you put that food in your pocket and show them that the food is now gone, what you're effectively teaching or effectively doing is you're punishing the jumping up behavior by removing the chance of a treat. So that's the negative, where you've removed the treat because you're trying to punish the jumping up behavior. And what you're teaching the dog is the more they jump up, the less food they're going to get.
Okay. I'll ask a question about that in a second, but I don't want to derail your thought process.
No worries. I do this quite a lot anyway. So if you want to ask that question now, then we can jump on to positive punishment. That's fine.
So what I was going to say was, so some dogs, they won't care that the treat's gone in the pocket. They'll just keep jumping up.
Yeah.
So how do we deal with that?
Good question. So again, this is why I put this one in amber, because you sometimes get dogs who are frustrated and don't quite learn or don't quite offer the correct behavior immediately. So that's where we would start to step in and guide the dog into a more positive position. So we would then be looking at things like incompatible behaviors or basically mutually exclusive behaviors. And that just means if they're doing one thing, it means they physically can't do something else. So in other words, if you train a sit and the dog is rewarded for sit, they physically can't jump up and stay in the sit at the same time. They're incompatible behaviors. So if you've put more emphasis on the sit, the dogs are less likely to jump anyway, because you've already given them a constructive method of gaining attention and gaining reinforcement by just simply offering a sit rather than trying to jump for attention or jump for a treat.
So if someone's got a dog that just keeps jumping up, a way that they could start to try and stop that would be to ask the dog to sit.
Absolutely. Build in a strong sit. Now, obviously be mindful, because some dogs find sitting uncomfortable, and that comes kind of lines in perfectly with what you do as well. So you might just opt for a stand to start with. It doesn't really matter what you ask for, as long as there's four paws on the floor. And once you've got that, once you've been asking for that behavior a few times over, then what you would try and do is wait for the dog to offer it naturally rather than ask them. So then you've got an option of going, right, well, if you offer this job instead of me telling you what to do, it means you know the dog's in a much more kind of a thoughtful or thinking mindset. But also the fact that they've offered those behaviors themselves, in my experience, makes that behavior stick a little bit stronger.
Okay. And then finally then, so positive punishment, which sounds like it's a good thing, but actually I'm pretty sure it's not.
Yeah, that's the red flag. This one's the red one in the traffic light system. So positive punishment is adding something that aims to punish that certain behavior. So for argument's sake, a dog that growls or barks at the window and is punished or hit or sprayed with a water pistol to stop the barking, you're adding something, which is a spray, to try and punish or discourage the barking behavior. The problem with this, and I've had lots of dogs in the past who have done this, where school times, when there's lots of kids walking past, the dogs are more alert at the windows, they'll bark and the owners spray them, they'll use air correctors, they'll use water pistols, they'll yell, all sorts of weird and wonderful things that they'll use to try and discourage the behaviour. And sadly, what happens is the dog associates the punishment not with the behavior that they're doing, but what was in the environment at the time. So then the dog starts to think, well, hang on, every time this child walks past, I keep getting shocked. So I don't want to see this child. And one of the dog's coping mechanisms for that is, well, I'm going to try and bark them as far away as I can. And so you're in this kind of self or kind of negative cycle of events, where the more the dog barks to move the child away further, the more they're punished. So the more that connection grows, and they go, well, I really don't want this child to be near this house anymore. and you can start to see where that kind of snowballs from as well.
So then the dog could then just become reactive, yep, to kids because of the association, yep, of the original problem that they were trying to solve, but actually you just created another problem. Yep. So I'm thinking there's probably people listening to this thinking, oh my God, are there things that I'm... So what are like the typical things that owners may be doing that are positive punishment, but they may not even realise that actually it's not necessarily a good thing to be doing. So what are the typical things that you... Are there any that kind of spring to mind? You think, oh, I always see this.
Yeah, so the old... That one's a big one where people will try and interrupt a behaviour, or they'll do like a... because they've seen it on TV and they think it works. For the most part, it's just aggravating to the dogs. But there's certain dogs who, you know, who really take offence at that sound and they start to panic just on the sound. But... And the problem with that is they're being told not to do something, but we're completely missing out on the stuff that we do want them to do. So it's, you know, if you don't want the dog to do something, then instead of just telling it not to do something, you're better off starting to say, well, look, I'd rather you do this instead and train that up to a good standard, because that means the stuff that you do want the dog to do has become much more reinforced than the stuff you don't want them to do.
But I'm thinking there might be things that... So, for instance, say a dog wants to go rushing out to get in the car because they want to go for a walk. So you open the front door and they're like, you know, they're wanting to kind of just get in the car because they're so excited. So I can think of, you know, there might be an owner that's going to go, you know, wait for, you know, to sit or what have you. So I'm thinking there might be it's probably quite an innocent thing,
absolutely,
isn't it? I mean, because you're not actually hurting the dog by saying that, are you? You're not physically... hurting them. You're just saying, I don't want you to jump in the car because I'm not ready for you yet, or, you know, there could be someone walking past or what have you. So so in that situation, then I guess you should be trying to encourage them to sit and or just wait by the front door before you've opened it up and that type of thing.
Brilliant. So all you're really doing at that point is to say, right, how do I want this setup to look? How do I want it to go from being in the house to being in the car? What does that transition period look like for me? And if that's, I want the dog to wait at the door, I want to be able to clip the lead on, I want to walk calmly to the boot and then open the boot and have the dog jump in, then you've already got your sequence that you can train. So you start with training at the door, have some manners for the sits and waits at the door, then you open the door and you walk out. You'd then be practicing things like loose lead, then you get to your car and you revisit the wait or the sit and wait, lid comes up, and then you use your release cue to kind of get them to jump in. So really that whole sequence can be broken down into maybe 3 or 4 pieces that can all be trained separately, so you don't just have to keep doing the same sequence over and over again. You can break it down into little bite-sized chunks, which is good for people, because, you know, we don't want to spend half an hour doing the same thing, it gets boring. And if we find it boring, then your dog's definitely going to find it boring. So breaking it down into little small bite-sized chunks that you can then piece together as a bigger jigsaw puzzle makes that route a lot easier from the dog being coming way over the top and overexcited, and then getting to the field and just carrying all of this added anxiety, or not so much anxiety but adrenaline and frustration, and then spilling that all over when the dog's jumped out the car and flying around at 100 miles an hour. You've managed to slow that whole sequence down to better prepare you for when you do get to where you want to go for the end journey.
Okay. And what's another kind of example? Because I'm just thinking there's probably loads. I mean, I don't expect you to be, but what's like another one that you see owners doing quite frequently that they probably wouldn't even realize?
So things, I mean, the water pistol thing is still a massive it's still a massive thing where they've got like a little air spray or a water pistol, and anytime the dog offers an unwanted behavior, they'll get a spray of air, like a compressed air, or get a squirt of water. Those little things are still really commonplace. It's amazing how many people still use that sort of stuff.
So they're definitely things that we want to be avoiding, not just because it's not a particularly nice experience, but actually what potentially is happening is that you're actually then, like you gave the example about the kids thing, is like you're actually then potentially creating other problems, and you're going to have to then solve other problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's all based on conditioning. So you've got the operant conditioning that we're looking at now, but you've also got the classical conditioning as well, which is where you kind of bypass the dog's you bypass their voluntary response, and it's much more of a subconscious thing that happens as an association at that point as well.
So what's an example of that?
Well, in terms of classical condition is basically when something happens and then something else happens immediately after that, and those associations are made. So I'm hopeful that this will transfer through the microphone. So if I do this and just tap a pen against the side of a glass.
It sounds like you're about to make a speech.
Exactly, exactly. And that's classical conditioning in a nutshell.
Ah, there you go.
It's like I've done this for years. But so that's classical conditioning, because it happens on such a subconscious level that every time you've heard that sound in the past, a speech has happened or an announcement has happened immediately afterwards. So through repetition, that's what you expect to happen afterwards. Now, if you go back to the dog on this, and every time the dog sees a child and they get sprayed, that association is made just as quickly as our association with the announcements that we've just heard there.
Okay, everyone. So hopefully this has kind of got your appetite now going for lots of different information about behaviour. So please make sure you check out part 2 of my conversation with Adam. Thanks for listening to the It's Not Just One Thing That Will Help Your Dog podcast. I really hope you've enjoyed it and found it useful. If you'd like any more information about anything that we've been discussing, please contact me. You can find my website by googling Physio My Dog. You can also look me up on Facebook and Instagram under the same name, Physio My Dog. I look forward to hearing from you.